Welcome to this Science Progress podcast. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm the editor-in-chief of Science Progress, and today my guest is Dr. Ruth Fadin. Ruth is executive director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and the Philip Franklin Wagley Professor in Biomedical Ethics at Johns Hopkins. And Ruth is a well-known bioethicist and also has a strong interest in the ethics of what is known as comparative effectiveness research, and that's what we're going to be talking to Ruth about today. Welcome, Ruth.
Well, thank you, Jonathan.
We're in the middle of a period in which there's a lot of talk about, you know, sort of wither healthcare and, in particular, health insurance. There's a lot of technical aspects to this, and at Science Progress, we're very interested in how science can be promoted for the common good, and there's no better example of that than in medical care. There's one piece of this discussion that is very technical and about which you happen to be an authority, and that is the idea of comparative effectiveness research. Can you explain what that is?
I can try. It's actually a really simple concept with a very fancy term.
Yeah.
The basic idea here is that we're doing healthcare intervention. So we're doing a direct comparison of interventions that are currently available to determine which works best, which produces the best outcomes, which produce the most harms, and for whom.
And when you talk about interventions, could you break that down a little bit?
Yes, absolutely.
What does that mean? What are interventions?
It could be medical treatments. It could be diagnostic interventions. So we could be looking at two different ways to diagnose the problem, or three different ways. We could be looking at two or three different modalities for treating a problem. So problem is backache, we could be looking at massage and physical therapy against bed rest, against surgery, for example. And the idea is to try to head-on compare different ways of either diagnosing a medical problem or treating a medical problem to determine which of the different options produces the best outcomes on balance for which patient.
Do you discriminate between different kinds of patients?
Right, absolutely. Because part of the trick is trying to figure out what works for whom.
Yeah.
Clearly, medicine doesn't work in a one-size-fits-all frame of mind. So one of the key questions comparative effectiveness research is designed to address, and in fact, some people think it may be the most important question, is exactly this issue of whom. In whom does what work best?
And is there a lot of this kind of research now? That is to say, comparing, say, a new drug with patient education?
There's not nearly as much as we need.
Again,
if you ask people who are experts in healthcare policy, and if you ask physicians who really are concerned with being able to do the best by the patient, they will say to you, we don't have nearly as much evidence as we would like.
Is there an example that comes to mind pretty easily where, it looks like comparative effectiveness research really has been useful?
There have been. So a good example would be work that has been done recently in trying to figure out which interventions are best for certain kinds of heart patients. And there has been work that's shown that depending on the age of the patient, and that's what's really, really interesting, one approach is better than another. Whereas if you didn't aggregate it by age or even by gender, you wouldn't know which approach would be best for which patient.
So the studies themselves have shown that, or is that some fancy statistics that people have done after
the studies? Now, that's an interesting question as well. Comparative effectiveness research doesn't necessarily mean generating brand new data. It can. So it can mean that you design brand new studies that involve complicated designs in order to get this head-on comparison that you're looking for.
And that would be very expensive to do a lot of that.
It is often expensive, of course.
Yeah.
You can also do comparative effectiveness research looking at data, synthesizing data that have already been collected. There are obviously limitations to that approach.
Yeah.
But the basket of comparative effectiveness research ranges from brand new information collected expressly for practical purposes through to synthesizing data that have been collected for multiple purposes to see if we can get some sense of where the evidence lies.
So that helps us to understand why The president's budget really doesn't allocate that much for comparative effectiveness research, you know, in the scheme of things.
In the scheme of things, it sounds like a huge amount of money.
$1 billion.
Yeah, $1 billion is a huge amount of money for most for most of us when we think about it. But indeed, this is expensive work to do, and the payoff is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's been sort of the orphan of clinical and biomedical research because it is so practical.
Hmm. So does that mean that in order to generate all this information, that you would have to hire statisticians? Who would actually do it? How do people envision this actually working out? If industry isn't that interested, if it's expensive for academia, they'd have to hire new people. Who would do it?
Well, the good news is that there are people all over the country, indeed all over the world, who are well set up mm-hmm. to do this work, ranging from people who are clinical trial specialists, so people who really know how to set up clinical trials, and in particular what we now increasingly call practical trials, trials that are really designed to be immediately useful to clinicians,
mm-hmm.
very practical trials, through to clinical epidemiologists, people who are expert at looking at data that have been collected through multiple modalities and trying to think through essentially the epistemic, the questions about how causally relevant these different ways of collecting the information are, putting it together, and allowing us to draw conclusions. So there's a wide range of people who are well-trained. We could use more people, but there's mm-hmm. a wide range of people.
So you mean that when you say causally relevant, you mean that some of the information that people might get from studying these old clinical trials or comparing the results might really give you an insight into some things that work because there's a kind of a mechanical relationship between A and B mm-hmm. and more than just a correlation?
If you can.
Yeah.
Right, if you can. You're also looking at large observational studies, for example, that are mined by clinical epidemiologists for the inferences that you can reasonably draw from those kinds of databases. Mm-hmm. And you also can put all of this together, which is what's so exciting in comparative effectiveness research, where you really are trying to synthesize the evidence as best as you possibly can. Now, sometimes you just don't have the evidence.
Right.
And that's where it gets really expensive and problematic. And arguably, a lot of the money that has been allocated will go towards that very difficult work.
It occurs to me that what's disconcerting to many people probably hearing about this kind of thing is that people like to think that their doctors already have evidence, that they have good reasons for suggesting a certain drug or a certain approach to their medical problem. As people who've taught in medical schools who are not doctors, not medical doctors,
right.
We know that, sadly, so much of what medical students are taught now still is not necessarily well-grounded in evidence.
It's very unnerving, actually.
Yeah.
And it's unnerving for the best clinicians as well. In some cases, they have a good evidence base, both in terms of the literature and also in terms of their own clinical experience to rely on to make very, very sound judgments in terms of advising their patients and treating their patients. But there are lots of cases where good clinicians will just acknowledge, we're really not sure.
Mm-hmm.
We're really not sure what's going to work for you because we just don't have information that's specific enough to the kind of patient you are and the kind of condition you're presenting with.
Without getting too far into the speculation about how comparative effectiveness research might inform future healthcare in America, which is very speculative at this point, let's imagine that there was, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, there was a lot more of this information out there. That academic scientists who are, as you say, in a good position to do this kind of analysis have generated a lot of information for us of
right.
a comparative nature.
Mm-hmm.
How would that actually be used by a doctor? That is to say, how would that get to a doctor? And, would the doctor be required to pay attention to it?
Required, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraged, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the normative structure of medicine is that people want to do the right thing. I mean, physicians really do care. They spend a lot of time, and I don't mean to be Pollyannish about this. But
they don't want to fail.
They don't want to fail. They actually really want to help their patients. So a good doctor really tries to stay up with the literature and tries to understand for the kinds of treatments, the kinds of diseases that they address, the kinds of patients they have, what what's the best way to proceed. Mm-hmm. There are many, many vehicles that can be used, from clinical practice guidelines to advisories, mm-hmm. To continuing education vehicles for helping clinicians make use of the kinds of information that comparative effectiveness research will yield. But I don't want to minimize. There is a real translation problem.
Yeah.
So engaging the community of practicing physicians and also practicing nurses in this work will be very important. And mm-hmm. a lot of the best centers are thinking about community engagement at that level, where the community, in fact, is the practicing community, the community of practicing physicians and, mm-hmm. and clinicians of all stripes. But what we would see, if we're lucky down the road, is fewer patients being harmed.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge that sometimes people go into the hospital and they get set back rather than improved in terms of their health.
Yeah.
In some cases, that's because of accidents or errors. In other cases, it's because we just don't know that something is going to be harmful for a particular kind of patient.
Uh-huh.
So we would expect errors. We would expect fewer people to be harmed by the medical care that they receive.
When bad things, you know, do happen, unexpected things, would there be kind of a feedback mechanism so that somehow that individual experience of a doctor
right.
and a patient could be part of the data?
Well, now we're going from comparative effectiveness research, Jonathan, into the wider context
right.
of whether we're going to have the kind of intelligent medical, mm-hmm. computerized medical records.
Yes,
will allow
and this is
for
where the, we connect to what's called bioinformatics.
That's correct. Yeah. So now we're connecting the dots,
yeah.
if you like.
Yeah.
And in the ideal healthcare system, there would be this continuous feedback loop. We talk
mm-hmm.
about a total learning environment,
mm-hmm.
one in which everything that happens is immediately information that's available to make sure that the next time around things are done in a way that's slightly better
mm-hmm.
for the next set of patients that come down the road. And the goal will be ultimately to have an integrated system that is, on the one hand, of course, is very mindful of patients' privacy and their personal preferences, and at the same time lets all of us, current patients, future patients, we cycle in and out,
mm-hmm.
all of us as patients and consumers and as citizens in the system, that all of us will always be better off because we'll be looking at this information critically. You wow. always learn.
Yeah.
You always should learn.
And in that total learning environment, there would be ways to make sure that that it's not garbage in, garbage out.
Well,
that's the trick. Right?
Right, that's part of it. This is not easy.
Not easy.
Right.
Yeah.
This is not easy to do,
yeah.
but it's doable, I as I understand it from the people who know better than I do about what it'll take to implement it.
You know, I want you to talk a little bit about the British system.
Yes.
But before we do that, I want to make sure that we challenge the notion that comparative effectiveness search is necessarily the road to rationing. I mean, I said a few minutes ago, will doctors be required to use this information? And you said, no, they probably wouldn't be required to. But that's what a lot of people are worried about. So could you talk a little bit
sure.
about that?
Sure. Sure. There are two pieces to this.
Mm-hmm.
One piece of this is comparative effectiveness research. And if you take the two words and you take them apart, you've got comparison and effectiveness. You're
mm-hmm.
comparing different diagnostic techniques, different treatments to see which is most effective for what kinds of patients.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we're not talking at all about cost.
Right. This is
right.
not cost effectiveness,
right.
which is the term
right.
that was bandied
right.
about
right.
20 years ago.
Right. So let's just separate the two for
yeah.
a moment. The first set of considerations has to do with, okay, if we compare drug A with drug B, which produces the best balance of medical benefit to medical harm
mm-hmm.
for what groups of patients?
Mm-hmm.
That's comparative effectiveness research.
Yep.
A related question is, how much does it cost,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
to use drug A to achieve this benefit versus drug B to achieve that level of benefit
yeah.
or net benefit? And then when you take comparative effectiveness and you add cost to it, you get cost effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking then at the value
yeah.
that you achieve for the money invested as you do this comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to couple the two together by any means. They're separate enterprises.
So it would be sort of a political decision if you decided to couple
it's
them,
a,
wouldn't it?
It's a political decision if you're talking about national systems
right.
or shared healthcare systems like Medicare, for example. It's a private sector decision if you're talking about insurance companies and the way in which they operate.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that actually does open the door to talking about the British system, which has a memorable acronym, which is NICE.
Yes.
And can you tell us what NICE stands for? And is it NICE?
Well, NICE is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
NICE is called the National Institute for Clinical NICE stands for, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's connected to the National Health Service. So we have to step back, and I'm sure that everyone listening appreciates that the UK has something called the National Health Service, which is just what it sounds. It's a national health care system for every resident of the country, where medical care is free at the point of service. So you just show up and you're cared for and there are no bills. And it is financed by a modestly progressive national tax.
Right.
Okay. So it's a uniform, universal health care system. In 1999, the English and Welsh parts of the National Health Service instituted or created this special institute, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, and gave it several charges. One of the charges, a key charge, had to do with establishing value for investment. So if the British, the Welsh, and English public is investing all this money, can they maximize the value in terms of health outcomes for the amount of money that they're putting into this?
Right.
That was one goal. Another goal was to establish essentially which treatments are the most effective and most worthy of support or coverage in the National Health Service. So that was also a very important objective.
Mm-hmm.
And another objective was to iron out what seemed to be different practice patterns in different parts of the country. It looked like some people were getting access to medicines and treatments in some parts of England and Wales and not in others. And there was concern about that. We have something similar, by the way, if you look at Medicare practice patterns in the United States. So there was great concern that perhaps not everybody is getting as good care in England and Wales as they should. And in fact, one of the parts of the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, or NICE, in the UK that people don't appreciate is that it was expressly set up to actually increase the uptake of certain expensive interventions in the UK, in particular cancer drugs. That was part of the remit that went to NICE. Now, NICE is in a structure that's very different from anything we have in the United States right now and very different from anything that is seriously on the table in the near term for health reform in the United States.
Yeah.
It's in a structure, as I've said, of a uniform, universal national health care system. And in that context, NICE has an authority that we don't have any structure for, and no one is envisioning a structure for it in the U.S. at the moment. If NICE conducts, and they do cost effectiveness analysis, so they do comparative effectiveness analysis and cost effectiveness analysis. They do both, so we've already talked about the difference.
Right.
If, as a result of a cost-effectiveness analysis, NICE recommends that a drug, for example, be covered, that generates immediately a universal entitlement throughout England and Wales. Oh. Every resident of the country is now entitled to that cancer drug.
You can imagine how that could get very expensive.
Well, that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah.
So they have to deal with this question of we can't cover everything, given that we're creating universal entitlement. And so that's where essentially the path goes to rationing. There's an explicit recognition in the UK that the commitment of the National Health Service is to provide high-quality medical care to every resident of the country free at the point of service. That's to say, free to you as the patient. You've paid for it, in a sense, through tax dollars, right? But it's also recognized in the UK that in order to accomplish that goal, it's not possible to give absolutely everybody in the country absolutely everything that might offer some prospect of benefit, no matter how small. So there you are talking about a structure in which explicitly there's a recognition of limits.
It's hard to imagine a system like that prevailing in a political culture like ours. So what people really are talking about right now is getting the data out there that can sort of, as you said earlier, influence the culture of medicine.
Yes, and the expectation notion is comparative effectiveness research will not only decrease the likelihood that people are actually harmed by the care they receive, which occurs sometimes. I don't want people to get concerned that we're causing widespread harm to patients, but also that it will improve the quality of care.
Yeah, and thereby save money.
Exactly. So what we know, what we're sure of, is that some patients get medical care that they don't need, or they get medical care that's really not as good for them, will not make them as well as quickly as something else might. And if we have the evidence that says, you know, for this kind of patient, we really should be doing drug A and not drug B, or we should be doing this kind of surgery and that not that kind of surgery, we will save money.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you treat somebody with something that turns out to be wrong for them, odds are you have to treat them again.
Mm-hmm.
They're still not better.
So it sounds like you think this is going to happen, this comparative effectiveness approach is going to happen eventually anyway. That it's as long as we're generating all this data and people know that it's a good idea to compare, that eventually there will be opportunities to use this information, whether it's done systematically, encouraged by government or not, or is that wrong?
I'm not sure how to take that apart. Jonathan, there are a couple of pieces there. One piece is how much comparative effectiveness research will in fact be done, say, over the next 5 years or over the next 10 years.
Somebody's got to fund it.
Somebody's got to fund it.
Right.
Right. And so that's part of why this appropriation of $1 billion, $1 billion plus, that's, what it, that's what that appropriation, that investment is intended to kick off.
And we're going to be seeing that work done over the next couple of years?
Precisely.
Yeah.
Right. So that work's going to be done, and that work should have, hopefully, a dramatic effect. I mean, dramatic. We should learn a lot.
Yeah. So 5 years from now, we should be able
more.
To see we've learned more.
Right. We should know more. And presumably, not only will we know more, but people will use that information in order to better the health of Americans.
Right.
That's really the goal. The hope is that you just don't learn the stuff, that people actually use it, and that patients have access to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're an increasingly sophisticated patient population that goes to the web, listens to podcasts, looks up and Googles their medical condition and their symptoms, and as comparative effectiveness studies are released about whatever your medical problem is, diabetes, coronary artery disease, Parkinson's, you name it, you'll have benefit of this information as well.
The boomers want to know.
We want to know.
Yeah.
Right. I'll put myself squarely in there, right? We want to know, right?
So let's agree that in 2 years, you know, you'll come back, we'll do another podcast, and we'll ask you to tell us what the most interesting results have been of the ramp-up in comparative effectiveness research.
My pleasure.
That'd be great.
Take care, Jonathan.
So we've been talking to Ruth Faden, Executive Director of the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins, who is, as you those who have been listening can tell, a renowned and very clear instructor in matters of ethics and health policy. Thank you again, Ruth.
My pleasure.
And thanks for listening to the Science Progress podcast. I'm Jonathan Moreno. Talk to you again.